Good morning. If you got my email, how many of you got my email regarding this Sunday? So you know what this Sunday is about. I have not prepared a message. It's a dialogue time for you to have the opportunity to ask questions of life and faith or theology or the future of the church or whatever you want to ask. I'll give you an update on the report. I did get the results of the biopsy and basically confirmed what we already knew, what I've already been sharing with you. I have pancreatic cancer. It's metastasized. It's spread. It's stage 4. And I'm going to be enrolling in hospice, and I have basically up to 6 months, is what they said, to live. And so that's nothing new. You've heard all of that. And Aloise and I are in process of all that. My family's doing well with it. And this Sunday may be the last Sunday that I'll be speaking, because next Sunday we have the 5 Church Thanksgiving service. And the Sunday after that we'll have Barbara Rowe, Aloise's sister, coming from El Salvador, whose mission we support in El Salvador. But I may ask to speak one more Sunday, the Sunday following that, December 2nd. I'll talk to the leadership team about that. But this Sunday is time for you to ask any questions that you may have, and we can dialogue. So it's up to you. That's why I sent the email, so you would know ahead of time. Jen.
Things that have been on your mind, like how will you, I hate the word legacy because that's such but anyway, how do you feel that you would like to continue communicating? Because I feel that you probably have a lot to say, and even if it's just notes on paper somewhere that somebody puts together later, I would hope that everything that's on your mind and that you want to say in all of, not just about what you're going through, but your life experience, like, will you get your blog or something back up and going?
That's a good question, because I have been thinking about my writing. By the way, I have an article that came out in the Mennonite about my Parkinson's experience, and the Mennonite is the denomination's magazine periodical, and it came out in this month, so I don't know how many of you have read it or seen it. Just one or two. So that was one way. I stopped writing the blog a while back, and I don't anticipate writing again in the blog. But you are right in asking the question, because I've been thinking along that lines, and it's a matter of how much energy I have, because believe it or not, writing takes a lot of energy from me at this point. And some days are better than others in terms of how much energy I have. But that's one of the reasons why I needed to ask to be relieved of my duties at the end of this month, because I don't have the energy to keep on coming in to the office and doing my work. But maybe in December I may have freedom to write. So, but that is the way I express that you're right on in terms of what you're asking. Thank you for asking that. Jason.
Thank you. It's not a question. It's more of to commend you, because, as I've told you before, you were one of the main reasons that I came to this church, because, like, music, I don't really care about music. I'm not, or social interactions either. I come to church to hear the word of God, because my relationship with God is what's most important in my life. And in my opinion, I think you did a great job doing that, because I've always felt, in terms of the role of a pastor, we don't need motivational speakers and we don't need political commentators. We need teachers of the word. So thank you.
Thank you. Janine, and then Kim.
Maybe everyone else knows this, but I don't know this story. I would like to know how you and Eloise met and how you fell in love, and when did you know that she was the one for you?
That's a good question. Thank you for asking. I have a story about that. I met her parents before I met her. I was an associate pastor at a small church in East Los Angeles, and her parents, her father was professor of missiology and anthropology at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, and they are Mennonite brethren background, and the church that I was associate pastor in was a Mennonite brethren church. And so they wanted to, we were the only Mennonite Brethren Church in the LA area, including Pasadena, at that time. And so they came to our church a year prior to me meeting Eloise. And her parents were very supportive of me and would take me out to dinner quite often after a Sunday service, take me out to lunch. And I was living, my roommate was Mike Gomez. Some of you have met him. He was a professional chef. And when I shared his house, he said to me, because I'm a chef, don't expect me to cook. And I said, okay, I don't, you know, I get that. But I decided I wanted to give back to her parents. So I said, Mike Gomez, would you help me cook something for Paul and Fran? Because they take me out every Sunday and I like to do them a favor and cook for them. And they said yes. Well, then that very Sunday morning, Paul comes to me and he says, Mike, I know you invited me and Fran, but our daughter has come up unexpectedly from San Diego. Would you mind if she joins us? And our daughter, meaning Eloise. And I said, sure, no problem. And the only vehicle that I had was a motorcycle. That's how I got around all of L.A. and the L.A. freeways, that was a motorcycle. So I met Eloise that Sunday morning, and I asked her, I said, oh, yeah, you come out, you're glad to have you and having your parents. And I said, would you like to ride with me? And I said, I've got a motorcycle. And she said, yes. I was surprised. I was pleasantly surprised. I said, oh, she's willing to go on the motorcycle with me. So we rode from the church to the house where we lived there and where Mike and I shared that home in East Los Angeles. And that meant taking three different freeways. Short drive, but it was just three. And so I got on one the freeway and then one on the other one. You have to know LA to know what I mean by that. And she grabbed on tightly and not a word from her. I said, how did you do after we got in? Fine. And later on I found out that she didn't have how did you put it? And that's how we met. And then I called her up a few times and we started relating. And what's interesting is that Sunday that we met and that Mike Gomez helped me cook the meal for her parents and her, she thought I could cook. So when our relationship got to the point where we got engaged and we were talking about our marriage and what have you, there was a point where we were talking about plans and I don't know what the conversation led to, but she said at one point in the conversation, Mike, are you assuming that I'm going to do all the cooking? And yes, I was assuming that, but I didn't know how to say that to her given the way she was acting. She was, I said, what did I say, yes? Or, I paused, knowing that she, the very way she was asking the question, she didn't expect to do all the cooking, and I didn't know how to cook really, you know. So, for about a week or two, while we were getting ready to go to India, I spent time in her parents' house trying to cook, and she saw how miserable I was, and she says, "Mike, I understand. I'll do the cooking." Eloise. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's up there.
I have a comment about that. You were wearing flip-flops. Oh, yeah. You never let a woman ride a bike wearing flip-flops.
Oh, well, that picture was taken on the bike. It was a setup.
Okay.
That day, she was not wearing, because you are correct. I would never wear flip-flops, and I would never allow.
I picked that right up.
Yeah. So, yeah. When I see, I've seen guys riding motorcycles and flip. I can't believe that, you know, I've always worn boots when I drive the motorcycle, so I get your point.
So that picture is from your beginning?
Yeah.
That meal train picture, I was like, kind of young.
I guess to maybe piggyback a little bit with Janine, did you get down on your knee?
Say that again?
Did you get down on your knee when you proposed?
No.
And where did you propose that? Did you propose
in
India
car.
Or did you propose
that? Just had lunch at Sir George's, which I found out, by the way. See, because I was a bachelor and because I was living with a chef who didn't want to cook at home, The way I ate is I ate one big meal a day at a smorgasbord. It's called Sir George's. And I took her to Sir George's. I liked it. I found out later that she didn't really like the food. I didn't know that at the time. But after that, in the car, because of the conversation led up to it, I proposed in the car after, when we were getting ready to go home.
Another question I have is, where did you do all of your seminary work, and were you born into the Mennonite religion?
No, I was raised and brought up in a nominally Roman Catholic home, and what I mean by that is that we were Roman Catholic, but we were the type that only went to church on Easter and Christmas. We were not practicing Roman Catholics in any serious way, but that's what my faith background was, and I did go to the Catholic Church. In fact, when I was 9 years old, I had wanted to become a priest, but I didn't tell my parents that until I was 10 years old because I thought they would find it amusing, and that's exactly the response that I got when I did tell them. They were amused by it rather than seeing it, how serious I was about it. That desire to be a priest, that desire to know the Lord. Let me back up. When I was 6 years old and I went to service, I remember sitting in the Catholic church and seeing the priest get up and do his thing, and then he had a homily and he gave his little sermon. I remember thinking to myself at one point, I wish I would know God the way he knows God. I'd like to be... It was a new, and I thought it was just such a mystery and so far-fetched for me, someone like me, to know God the way the priest did. But then when I was 9, I thought, I would like to be a priest. And then when I was 12, I went to a vacation Bible school at a Foursquare church. Have you heard of the Foursquare denomination? Okay. It started in Azusa, California, a movement. It was a charismatic movement. Back in 1900 and something, to forget what year. But the Foursquare Church's denomination came out of that revival period. And I know we went to that church, and at 12 years old, I went and received the Lord as my personal Lord and Savior, apologizing to the Lord for being in a non-Catholic church, because at that time we were taught that Roman Catholics should not enter any Protestant church at all. You know, and that and then... At 14, I went to a home Bible study given by a pastor, somebody that belonged to the First Fundamental Bible Church in East L.A., and that's when I started seriously walking with the Lord. Now, did I answer another part? What was the other part of the question?
And it's so funny that you said that you wanted to know the Lord the way that the priest knew the Lord. And this is going to be more of a comment. You have the Bible story, Martha and Mary, and Martha's running all around, and Mary is sitting at Jesus' feet and hearing everything he has to say. And, you have taken me to know the Lord in so many different ways. You have taught me things in the Bible that I never knew existed. You have seen me through some really pretty dark times. You've told me that my letter I wrote to my daughter was emotional blackmail. I feel like Mary, sitting at your feet, not literally, but I can only, there are no words, just thank you just isn't even enough to say everything you have done in my life, to my faith walk, and I just pray that you will, when you go to heaven and you're with the Lord, to continue to be with me and continue to show me the right way to go. And I feel ever so blessed that I have come to this church, that I have come to know you personally. I don't have any questions about the church, so to speak. I'm on the leadership team, and I'm sure that'll be asked or answered later. But I just want you to know that.
Thank you.
Well, I'm just going to say, Mike, you know, I was here when...
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was here when you came, and I know what type of minister you were then. And you were just a little bit arrogant. Just a little bit, I'm going to be who I'm going to be. Just a little bit. Just a little bit. You know, at least in my opinion. But then that's my opinion. But I've seen you grow. I've seen you listen. I've seen you change for the better. I've seen you walk with the Lord in a different way than when you came. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Thank you.
You've let God work in your life.
Thank you.
And change some of those not so pleasant attributes.
And Monica and Jen, or Jen and then Monica.
Are there any visions that you can share that you've had? I think there was like a hand coming down, or other visions that you feel comfortable sharing that you've had in the past?
Oh, you're talking about the dream that I had that I shared, and you're asking if I had another... anything like that. There was a dream, another dream I had a few years ago, where I was, let's see, how do I got to remember the details of how it went. There was a crowd of people, and Jesus was in the crowd. And Jesus, moved my way towards him. And he was inviting specific people to a banquet. And he turned to me and I asked him, he invited me and I said, and I questioned it. And he got a little stern because I questioned his invitation. Meaning, you know, like, don't, you know, you must accept my invitation. Don't question me about it. And I felt a little bit of embarrassment and even a little bit of being ashamed for questioning the invitation that he had. So, anyway, then the dream continued and I went to the banquet hall, which was a big, fancy building that had several rooms of tables. There was the first room, and then there was another room, and then there was the inner room. And the inner room is where Jesus was going to sit. So I go into the first room, and the people that are at the table look at me as if they looked at me as like, what are you doing here? Meaning, you don't belong here. And so I felt self-conscious, and I felt like, well, I was invited. But they said, there's no room for you here. You don't belong in this. So I went to the next room and almost got the same response, like, what are you doing here? And then I heard my name being called, and I went to the inner room where Jesus was. And Jesus says, Mike, come over here. I have a seat reserved for you right next to me. It reflected on how insecure I can be. Part of it is a lot of my experience growing up. For example, I told you the story when I was in second grade. Did I tell you when I did a bad thing? I threw sand at some girls sitting in the sandbox. And then I went to my classroom, which was, this was in my second grade. How old are you when you're in second grade? Seven? So I was about 7 years old. And the girls came and to the classroom, and the teacher said, may I help you? And she said, yeah. The girl said, yes, we are looking for someone. And then they saw me and says, oh, that boy, he's the one. He threw sand in us, and I got in trouble. Well, the very next, that was like, I think, a Friday. And so the next week on a Monday, this was the only teacher that I ever had in grammar school, grade school, what I call, that didn't assign seats for the students. The students were able to, as we came in, we could sit wherever we want every day. And the honor, what the students always tried to get was here's the teacher's desk right here, and there's the student's desk went lengthwise out of the teacher's desk. So 1, 2, 3, 4. Those four seats, do you follow what I'm picturing? Were the best seats to get. You know, seventh graders, they wanted to all be teacher's pets, so to speak, I guess, you know, to sit next to the teacher. And I seldom ever got in time to get one of those seats. But finally, I got that seat right next to the teacher, which was a place of honor, as we all considered it. And the teacher looked at me, and she stared at me with those glaring eyes and says, what are you doing here? And I thought, how do I answer that? I mean, you know, it's like, I got the seat. We can sit where we want it. And she says, I don't want you sitting here. You go to the back of the room. And so I went to the back. And she shamed me and embarrassed me because of what I did the week before. I threw sand and, you know. And I never forgot that experience. And I've had experiences like that, not quite as strong as that, but, you know, experiences of rejection and non-acceptance. And so that dream reassured, Jesus was reassuring me. He loves me, and he accepts me. Does that answer your question? That's an example. Monica.
Hi. I often feel like I miss out on traveling the world. I know you said you were a missionary in India. Is there other places that you were a missionary?
I was not a missionary in India. Eloise's parents were missionaries in India. And when we went to India, it was because Eloise was working on her doctorate, and she had to do some research there in India. And so we got married and then went off to India, spent a year, and almost a year in India, where she did her research in a place called Karnataka? South of Bangalore. And what I did is I lived like an aristocrat. I went to the library and did a lot of reading and enjoyed my free time, doing personal studies on my own. But I was not a missionary as such.
Well, anyway, I live in California, and I'm
California and end up here.
Alois, when she finished her doctorate and I finished my my work in the seminary to get my Master's of Divinity, we went to Arizona, where I pastored a Mennonite church in Arizona. And she finished her doctorate, and at some point we decided that she wanted to find a school where she can become full-time professor. And she wanted to apply to a Christian school, but we didn't want to live in the center of the U.S. We wanted to live on the coast, either the California coast, Oregon coast, or the East Coast. So she applied to a Christian school in Oregon, in California someplace, was it? Yeah, and the ones I remember are the ones in Oregon, because that's the places that I wanted to go to. And she did apply to Wheaton in Illinois, and she applied, of course, to Eastern. Wheaton wanted her, but they didn't have the funds to hire her right then and there. So they said, wait a year and we'll hire you, something like that. And Eastern was ready to have her now, so that's how we ended up in Eastern. And that's why we moved from Arizona to here, and then we've been there here ever since. Sandra? Excuse me. What?
Water. Do you want to drink?
Oh, do I want water? I have water right here.
Yeah. I guess my question is, when we had Bible study, we talked about the great cloud of witnesses. And I told you, we kind of, on our last night, we talked a lot of different things. And we talked about, you know, you being in our great cloud of witnesses and encouraging us. And I shared my experience on 422 afterwards. And you said to me, ask me the story about the tire on LA Freeway.
Oh, yeah. One of the first freeways that was built in the 1940s, the first freeways in the U.S. was the Pasadena Freeway. And it was built alongside the Arroyo Seco River. We call it a river in L.A. You would say it was a stream, but you know, until it floods, and then it becomes a wild river. And that river winds like this. So the freeway wound like along the same, you know. And it went from Pasadena, you know, Colorado Boulevard, where the Rose Parade, okay. It ended a few miles south of that, or it began, let's say, a few miles south of that, and it wound its way down to Los Angeles City, downtown Los Angeles. So I was coming from Pasadena, so I got on the Pasadena Freeway and driving that, and I was using Aloise's parents' car, and at that time they had a Chevette. Was it a Chevette? It was one of those cars that was just a lemon. It was a small little car, and I was on that freeway, and I was going to catch another freeway, the Pasadena Freeway to the Golden State Freeway, what we call the Golden State Freeway. And just before I was getting to catch that freeway, there was a truck in front of me, a pickup truck that had a whole bunch of tires on it. And the truck bounced, and one of those tires fell out of that truck. And I'm sort of, you know, about 5-6 car distance from the back of that truck. And I'm in the center lane, and the truck is in the center lane. It's a 3-lane. Freeway there, and the tire comes in, it's bouncing, and I'm thinking, what do I do? Because if I steer this way, I mean, because it's bouncing all over the place. So it's like, do I try to avoid it, or do I stay and hope that the tire goes in a different direction? Because there's no way of anticipating which way the tire will go, because it's bouncing all over the place. And so I decide, well, I'm going to stay where I'm at. I'm going to stay in the center lane. And lo and behold, the tire bounces this way, this way, this way, and then ends up right in front of me. And I just drive right over it. And the tire went flat, and I went right over it. And nothing happened. Now, I thought later, poor cars behind me. It was late at night because it was very few cars at that time, which is unusual for in L.A., the freeways are always full, even at nighttime. But this was unusually in. So I could only think that the Lord, the angels were with me because I could have lost control, hit the tire. The tire could have hit my front windshield. I mean, any kind of things could have happened. And that's a small car, and it just went right over it. And of course, we were going 55 miles per hour and when that happened. You know. So that's the story. Yeah.
Mike, how has your experience been at this church?
How has my experience been at this church? This church has taught me to love more practically and realistically. And this church has shown me compassion and love and support and mercy in a way that I just can't believe it. Like, you know, every year you would surprise me with the pastor's appreciation day, the things that you say, like what Kim said, and you know, Janine said, and other people say, has just buttressed my my sense of security for knowing that, I do touch people's lives, because I often wonder how. Because, like you said, my personality, I can be edgy, short-tempered, defensive, arrogant, and all those things. Just a little bit. And to have you guys reflect back to me that you have felt loved, and you have felt that I've given you meaningful messages has been very, very encouraging to me. Linda, and then Janine.
I'm not sure this is a question, but so even though your health hasn't been good for a couple of years, this diagnosis, I think, has taken all of us by shock and given us a sense of uncertainty about the future of our Sunday mornings here. But I have to say that even though as a Christian we all know and expect that we will go to heaven someday, I think we still desire to cling to life and enjoy life and the events of life that are facing us. And I've been so totally impressed, I guess, with your complete joy and desire to go to heaven and to be at peace with that. And even though Jake prays mightily for that power of healing, which I think we would all be thrilled to see, we know that you are certainly at peace with where you're at right now and where you are going. And hopefully, as we work through this process, that can give us a sense of peace, too. I'm not sure I'm there yet, personally, but it certainly is something that's emanating from you, and hopefully will help all of us be able to be okay with this now and in the future.
I'm glad to hear that. In fact, I called you the night before I was going to see the oncologist. Linda is a nurse, for those of you who don't know, and so is Jen Capone. And you warned me that oncologists have a tendency to, you know, come in, you know, what we can do. And that's exactly how he came in. He came in and he was came in running, saying, here's the possibility, here's the road you can take to, you know, treatment and this and this and this, and, you know, Fox Chase and UPenn and Second Opinion and this and we can. And I said, after I got tired of his rattling on. He just wouldn't stop. Right? Eloise was there with me. And, you know, and I said, wait, I said, what's the goal? To what end? And he paused and like, what was I asking? I said, what's the goal? And it's like, he paused and said, well, how did he answer? What did he say?
He shuffled around.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's why I can't remember how. He didn't know how to answer that. And I said, is it going to cure me? Well, no. I said, well, then why should I go through all this nonsense? Feeling side effects of chemotherapy and feeling sick. And it's not quantity of life. It's quality of life. And why should I extend the suffering and pain of dying with all this treatment nonsense? If I'm going to die anyway, it's not going to cure me. And he changed his total tune. And when he saw where I was coming from, he let down his guard and he says, I'm with you, I understand, and you are right. And he was very supportive. In fact, he was like saying, you are choosing the right path. But very few people do that. They want to do whatever they can to, you know, it's like, I've seen bad deaths and I've seen good deaths. And people, there was one family when I was a pastor in Arizona who, it was a mixed family. There was some who were believers and there were some who were not believers. The non-believers wanted to hang on to their mother's hang on to their mother and wanted everything to be done so she would not die. But she was dying. And she was in the hospital and she was suffering terribly and they were just lengthening the suffering process while she was dying. And she herself was afraid of death because her faith wasn't where her daughter's faith was. And the daughters were saying, give your trust in the Lord. Let yourself go. Don't fight it. It was a terrible death process because of what she was going through. That's a bad death. Then I've seen good deaths, Eloise's father and mother being a couple of examples, and my mother being an example, where they, when the time comes, they say, okay, I accept the fact that I'm going to die, and they die in peace. And they die taken care of in hospice. And there's such a difference. And so I've seen it modeled, I guess is what I'm saying. And I've always said, as my secretary knows very well, I said, well, between the two places, where would I rather be? I'd rather be in heaven. I mean, who wouldn't, when you really start to think about it, and I used this example before, maybe it's not a good example, but if you ask a child, where would you rather be? Here in the house, at home, going to school, or at Disney World? What would they say? Disney World. You know, it's like Paul even said that in Philippians. He says, I'm torn between wanting to be with the Lord or doing service here in the world. But I'd much rather be with the Lord. So I'm going home. I'm happy to do that. Sad to leave the family behind, and the family would be sad. But, you know, selfishly speaking, hey, I'm going to be up there having a party, so to speak. Oh, Janine and Jen.
All right, come on, y'all.
I guess this is kind of two questions, maybe kind of combined. Last week you spoke about the future of the church, and if we have the love of Jesus in our heart, you felt there would be no concern. In today's world, it's, for me, I guess I feel personally
responsible for not being able to share faith with people at work or wherever I am. And I kind of hold that in my heart. It's a pain. We want our church to survive, and we want to be able to spread the word in the world. And you're kind of a quiet person. Is there any advice or tips or talking points or of being able to do that easily without feeling, funny, having the strength and conviction behind you? But it's just, it's so hard for me to do that. I've tried, and you kind of get that, take that away somewhere. Yeah. And then how do we, as a church, where do you see our strong points and maybe some tips or things that we could use to continue and grow?
Yeah. To answer the first question, especially now, I'm finding it easier to bring up my faith, because when I'm talking to people, such as the medical people like the doctor or the insurance person, the health insurance person who called me from Aetna, I just naturally say, when they ask me, like when the doctor, the oncologist, I said, what's the goal? What's the end? And he paused, and I said, if it's not going to cure me, then why bother? But then I said in that context, I also said, see, I'm a man of faith. That's why it doesn't bother me. That's why I'm looking at, and I believe in Christ. And I said that same type of thing to the ER doctor when the ER doctor first told me that I had pancreatic cancer. And the insurance person, when the insurance person called me up and said, I'm your case manager, just want to follow up on your hospital stay and what you plan to do in terms of, the biopsy when you find out what that's, And I told her, I said, she asked me, what goals do you have? And I said, well, my only goal I have now is to process with the family and make sure that I tie any loose ends, if there's any issues that need to be resolved, to resolve it so that there's peace. And we've been doing that. There's really, both my daughter and son told me on one-on-one time that there was no issues, that they're at peace with me, that they have no problem to be resolved. And she said, I'm impressed, because, so point being is that I just use the natural conversation of where I'm coming from to bring up my faith. And that's basically what we all should be doing, is the natural context of a situation, if it's fitting, we say, well, it's because of my faith. It's because, may I pray, pray for you. I've been praying about this. Just out of the naturalness of who you are, you share your faith. And if they want to know more, you say more. If they don't say anything, that's fine. But you just let them know where you're coming from, that you have faith. Does that make sense? To answer the second question, I think that's what I tried to say last Sunday's sermon. I think this church has a great potential of being a powerful instrument of God's grace and mercy, because if you put Jesus first and desire to follow him in utmost obedience in honoring him, he will honor you as a people of God. But you have to put Jesus, you have the potential to do that, because it's here. You have love for Jesus. You worship him in genuine spirit. You have to work on your relationship with each other to make sure that there's no broken relationship, because that a divisive church or a divided church cannot grow. And so as long as you maintain peace with one another and forgive each other, you will do, and put Jesus first, you will do well as a church. And I know it's getting, if you, 11:35 now. We can continue if you have more questions, but I don't want to presume upon your time. But if there's any more questions.
Maybe answer this later. I always like knowing what people's favorite things are, whether it's their favorite author, story, Bible character, philosopher, musician, things like that. I would love to kind of have like a snapshot at some point, if you would write down or answer off the top of your head, you know, people's favorite movies and whatnot, what people's favorite things are, because I think it kind of, the literature and the readings and the music that people really love, I think, kind of gives us a snapshot of what kinds of influences are in their head and favorite allegories and fables and things like that. I love knowing what people's favorite things are. So in that vein, maybe not at this moment, but if you ever kind of write down your top ten.
Quick response to that is Charles Dickens and The Christmas Carol is my favorite story because of the transformation and redemption of Scrooge and how he became such a loving person afterwards. That comes to mind real quick. But anyway, there's more to it too than that. Yes? My favorite Bible verse is the Apostle Paul's words where he says, I have run the race, I have accomplished, you know, I'm ready to go home and receive the crown. That's one of my favorite Bible verses. The Bible verse that I would hope would be applied to me is where Jesus says, well done, my good and faithful servant. But I can't claim that until Jesus says that himself. All right. Worship team.